Freedom Radio. This is where the esoteric meets the political, and we are going to rewrite history here on this show every week. So if you want to keep up, keep things going, and learn more, come on over to www.freemantv.com. Get all your space war news and strange news of the weird. You won't want to miss a trip over there. Hours and hours and hours of infotainment. Well, off the bat, let's start with some news. Planned mission to the dark side of the moon, hopefully setting up a potential flight to Mars. And it seems that NASA is preparing and working with Lockheed Martin to send a project up to the dark side of the moon. Now, this will not be until 2016, however. But they're hoping to get the L2 Farside mission going in hopes of setting up a potential rocket combination of having the moon project the rocket straight to Mars in hopes of a coming Mars mission and to take off some of the time that it's necessary to travel that distance. Harvard scientists have found that these reverse aging process could be applied to mice and are hoping that it'll go to humans. Scientists claim to be a step closer to reversing the aging process after rejuvenating worn-out organs in elderly mice. The experimental treatment developed by researchers at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Harvard Medical School, turned weak, feeble old mice into healthy animals by regenerating their aged bodies. The surprise recovery of the animals has raised hopes among scientists that it may be possible to achieve a similar feat in humans, or at least slow down the aging process. Scientist says that what we saw in these animals was not a slowing down or a stabilization of the aging process. We saw a dramatic reversal, and that was unexpected. This could lead to strategies to enhance the regenerative potential of organs as individuals age and so increase their quality of life. We really could live forever and travel the stars. Report warns Obama about new dark ages. The two national security experts have issued a report through the Heritage Foundation that warns Obama and his officials to start working now to prevent and mitigate the damage from an electromagnetic pulse. The attack on the United States would be potential for unimaginable devastation. Not even a global humanitarian effort would be enough to keep hundreds of millions of Americans from death by starvation, exposure, or lack of medicine. This catastrophe would be described as the greatest catastrophe to ever happen in this nation. Measures are needed to add to the resilience of the electronic grid and the telecommunication systems, including duplicating some essential functions, and robust pre-disaster planning should be going on now. In our space news, we have a press conference by NASA. Curiosity grows as NASA sets extraterrestrial search update. A seemingly routine press release issued by NASA is causing a serious stir in the blogosphere today, with no small amount of hyperventilation about the possibility that scientists may have something to say about the discovery of extraterrestrial life. A press conference will be held this Tuesday, or Thursday, at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can get that right there in your Space War News with a link to NASA TV. Joseph Farrell. He is author of The Giza Death Star, Reich and the Black Sun, SS Brotherhood of the Bell, Secrets of the Unified Theory, The Philosopher's Stone, Nazi International, Roswell and the Reich, and Babylon's Banksters. He is author extraordinaire. I've been digging deep into all of his books, and boy, do I have a lot of questions for you tonight, Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's fantastic to have you here. We're about to rewrite history here, Joseph. Well, why don't we just start right off sure. Giza Death Star.
Sure.
So many people have gotten into deep research of the Great Pyramids and deciding and what they potentially could be and why they stand there. Now, just recently, we got this news article that an Egyptian archaeologist admits that the pyramids contain UFO technologies.
Right.
And this was Shaheen, who, with a vague response, said, "Well, I cannot confirm or deny this, but there is something inside the pyramid that is not of this world."
Right.
When we're starting to get news articles like this, it starts to make all of this seem a little more real.
Yep. Yeah,
what can you tell us about these the Great Pyramids and how they might function as a Death Star?
Well, to clarify things a bit, the three books that I wrote on that hypothesis are really only concerned with the Great Pyramid itself. They're not concerned with any of the other Egyptian pyramids, nor really with any of the other pyramidal structures in the world. But that said, one of the things I discovered or lay out the case for in those books is that if you look at the Great Pyramid and all of the dimensional analogs built into the structure of the local celestial space and its geometry, to be quite blunt, one of the things that just floored me was if you took the measures of some of those structures and converted the coefficients of quantum mechanics, in other words, you know, the bare number, if you converted those into the English system of measure, which is very, very close to the system of measure that was actually used to build the structure, and divided the dimensional measures of the Great Pyramid by those coefficients, you would oftentimes return near whole number results. So, in other words, it began to look to me as if we were looking at knowledge of physics principles that were only discovered in the very early 20th century. And, you know, those principles have led to a revolution in our technology, computers and everything else. So I'm looking at the structure and following kind of the lead of Christopher Dunn, who wrote a marvelous book on the Great Pyramid called The Giza Power Plant, in which he analyzes it from the standpoint of an engineer and came to the conclusion that it was a vast machine for the production of power. And that kind of sent me off because I had always had the lingering idea nagging in the back of my mind that the Great Pyramid represented some sort of military architecture. And in reading some of the ancient texts that were reproduced by Zechariah Sitchin in one of his books, in which he clearly points out that the texts make it sound as if this structure was built and conceived as some sort of advanced weapon system, I decided I'd pursue that idea because Sitchin, when he mentions that, he just, you know, he tosses it out there, and like he does so many times, he comes across an interesting idea, but he never pursues it. So basically, I decided to pursue the idea to see if, in fact, there was some physics evidence and some textual evidence that that may have been what it was.
Fantastic, because we only build things to that type of specifications if they are some sort of engineered tool.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I probably don't need to point out to your audience that the Great Pyramid in particular is built with optical precision. Its alignments are near perfect. Its the fittings of the stones are done to within the engineer specifications of a thousandth of an inch, you know, and the idea that this was cobbled together by a bunch of Egyptians using copper saws and diorite balls, you know, the nonsense that's put out by Egyptology. It just, you know, the structure itself belies any such explanation. And when you're dealing with optical precision, this does suggest that it does have some machine-like purpose in mind. And that fact, plus the fact that there are so many analogs of local celestial space. I mean, there's dimensional analogs of the speed of light, there's dimensional analogs of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, there's dimensional analogs of the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon, and on we could go. Well, you know, you don't build things like that into a structure if your intention is merely to conceive of a machine for the production of power. There's something else going on, and I suspect that it's military in nature. All the indicators, at least to my mind, point in that direction.
Sounds right to me, and what I've looked at. Sitchin left me with a bit of a mystery, too. He spoke of King Hiram of Tyre being taken off the planet and then returning to help build the temple to house the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
I wonder about these ideas of the kings of the world trying to leave the planet, like the Epic of Gilgamesh, where he's basically trying to get into deep underground bases and trying to fight his way in to find his way off the planet and go live with the gods.
Yes.
Does this play into your story at all? Because it looks like we're rebuilding this whole situation, only now.
Yeah. Well, it does actually play into my story in a wider sense, and I should mention to your listeners that may be unfamiliar with my books. When I began writing them, I deliberately conceived of them and in terms of a long arch of books. In other words, they're deliberately written in a certain order, and they're deliberately written to plug into each other. Each one kind of builds on the ones previous to it. Well, in that series of books, then, I wrote a book called The Cosmic War, in which I examined the textual evidences from ancient cultures, predominantly Mesopotamian, but there are some others as well that I examined, in which the idea is clearly spelled out that there was some sort of interplanetary war right here in our local solar system in very, very ancient times. And, of course, you get the idea in those Mesopotamian texts that we have genetic cousins out there somewhere that came here long ago and basically genetically engineered mankind into existence. And that implies, of course, a very sophisticated science, and if you have that kind of genetic science, you probably have a very sophisticated physics science as well. So, yes, that does play into my scenario, although I should specify that I don't get into elaborating that scenario when I wrote the pyramid books. That was kind of intended for down the line, but it's certainly a part of my thinking.
We need to take these ancient tales once again, the ideas of alchemy and ancient knowledge, the knowledge of Thoth, and rewrite this now into a modern equivalent. It
yes.
seems as if that's where you're going.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm in effect saying that if you look at ancient texts from the standpoint of either the actual discoveries or the theories of modern science, and in particular modern physics, what pops out of these texts more often than not is, in my opinion, a profound physics metaphor that if you learn to read the text in that way, they are describing some very, very modern ideas and even, in some cases, some very modern technologies. And one of the things I point out in the third book in that Giza Death Star series, a book called The Giza Death Star Destroyed, is that if you look at the ancient Babylonian version of the creation story, an epic that's called the Enuma Elish, and if you read it carefully, you're not reading a creation story at all. That's what academics have put out there as the theory for interpreting the text. But if you sit down and read that epic, and in particular the fourth tablet of that epic, what you're reading is an exact description of the signature effects of, for want of a better word, scalar weaponry or torsion-based weaponry that was used in the destruction of an entire planet, you know, and hence that's where I get the idea of kind of a Death Star. So, yeah, what I'm doing is basically decoding these texts on the basis or from the standpoint of modern physics and certain ideas within mathematics. So, yeah, I think you're exactly right there.
Well, we're seeing this come now forward into our time, and we're starting to see all of the deep underground military bases and things starting to set up. I'd like to go ahead and set the stage for our next segment, getting into the Nazis and their technological advancements of 1924 and 1925.
Right.
So would you like to open the door here of how the Nazis started to seek that knowledge and pretty much seemed to be doing the same thing you were doing, only had a lot more resources, I think.
Yes, the beginnings of what I think the Nazis were up to in World War II was that they had principally three different motivations or inspirations for what was being done. And the first two motivations come from the physics and engineering papers that were being published in Europe between the wars. And, you know, I get into that aspect of the story quite a bit in my books on the Nazi secret weapons, and in particular in a book called Secrets of the Unified Field. But there is a third component, and that does deal directly with ancient texts, in that the Nazis, when they took power, set up an entire department under the directive of Reichsfuhrer Himmler, who established this department of the SS that was called the Ahnenerbedienst. And this basically was the so-called Ancestral Research Bureau. But if you go to the Nuremberg Tribunal archive records and search and dig long enough, you'll find the directive that actually establishes this department of the SS. And if you read it, one of the things that Himmler specifically specifies as a mission brief for this department of the SS is that it is to examine all aspects of esoteric and occult tradition for the purposes of their potential military application. Now, that's a breathtaking statement, because in effect, what it means is that for the first time in modern history, you had major financial and personnel resources of one of the world's great powers, and a technologically sophisticated one at that, that was dedicated precisely to the recovery of presumed lost science and ancient technology. That's exactly what it means. So in a sense, when we're looking at the Third Reich and what they're up to and all this vast explosion of technology that took place in the 12 years of its existence, I do not think that you need look at explanations like crashed UFOs and, you know, reverse-engineered ET technology to explain why the Nazis came up with such incredible stuff, because it's there in the physics literature between the wars, it's there in the engineering literature between the wars, and most importantly, there is certainly inspiration from these ancient texts that Nazi scholars and scientists were certainly familiar with. So I think you can rationalize it all on the basis of purely terrestrial things. Although, again, these ancient texts do make it clear that at a very, very distant point in the mists of prehistory, there was some sort of extraterrestrial contact with, for want of a better expression, our genetic cousins. So, yeah, I think that's probably the way you have to look at the groundwork for what the Nazis were up to.
Well, it's going to get very interesting here, and I hope we can get deep into where we're at going today with the neo-Nazis of today. We want to discuss the bell. And, you know, some of these concepts that they came up with, like the over-the-horizon radar or the earliest computer, and now we're looking at a bitten apple on our computer as you got your Macintosh. And, you know, the swastika is your Columbia sportswear logo. I just wonder if they're not at the heart of our corporate creative world here.
Well, that's an excellent question. And in my opinion, you know, one of the things that is a basic thesis or part of my working model when examining this aspect of Nazi technology and hidden history and so on and so forth is that it is my opinion that Nazism survived the war, and it did so as a coherent political organization and entity with vast financial resources that allowed it to more or less continue independently of any of the victorious Allied powers, to continue independently its own research into some of these black technologies and sciences. And that's, in fact, what I think they did, and I argue that case in a book of mine called The Nazi International. But part of that, I think, to address the point that you raise in your question very directly, part of that, I think, is definitely that this post-war Nazi organization moved very deliberately into a relationship with the Anglo-American corporate elite. Because after all, at the end of the war, the Nazis are sitting on top of a huge, huge pile of liquid assets, cash, diamonds, gold, platinum, you name it. And they have to launder this money somehow, and the only people with the means to do it are the big banking houses in London and New York. And this, I believe, is what they actually did. They struck a kind of a post-war detente with their former enemies and all that money over to them to use as a means of expanding the West's ledger credit-making ability. But by the same token, I think what you had there implied is a dirty deal that at some future point, that marker is going to come due. So in other words, you're dealing with kind of a Mexican standoff situation. But yes, I definitely think that if you look at certain events in recent history, you can see the clear hand, you can see the clear stamp of an ideology that ultimately is fascist or Nazi in nature.
No doubt about it. And we can see it in our Hollywood programming come yes. to us left and right. Or even yes. just the recent Call of Duty with its zombie Nazis that you can
yes.
Dead ops. We are definitely getting written into this ideology, and personally, I blame a lot of it on Walt Disney.
Well, you know, there.
Hold on a second, Joseph. We'll be right back. You're listening to my wonderful guest, Joseph Farrell, here on Radio Freeman. We got a lot to cover. Welcome back. You know, Walt Disney put out a little collection of their wartime propaganda called Disney on the Front Lines. And in that video, they boldly pronounced that Joseph Goebbels had adopted Walt Disney's mind pattern programming techniques to program the Nazis and not the other way around. And when we realized that Walt Disney not only owns Hollywood Pictures, Touchstone, and all the Disney products, they also own Electronic Arts, computer gaming, and Marvel Comics, and in this way are instilling mind pattern programming into the children to start to bring about this new ideology of fascism.
Well, it is interesting that you mentioned Disney. I'm not aware of the nature of mind programming or anything like that, nor have I investigated Disney's connections to propaganda efforts, but I can say this. It is interesting to me that when NASA in the early 50s, or pardon me, late 50s, early 60s, decided to kind of put out its message, it contacted Walt Disney, and that began a series of relationships between Walt Disney and their production staff, and none other than so-called former Nazi Wernher von Braun, who was making these documentary films for Disney, you know. So, yeah, there's some sort of relationship there. That's very, very clear. And, you know, in these films, some of the most interesting of these Nazis was involved was a fellow by the name of Dr. Hermann Oberth, who is considered, along with Jack Parsons and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in Russia, as being one of the founders of modern rocketry. And Dr. Oberth, it's very interesting to note that this man was not only a real honest-to-goodness Nazi, but he was also very, very heavily involved and influenced by the occult. So, you know, take that for what it's worth, but it would seem to dovetail with what you're saying very directly.
Yeah, the more you look, the more you find.
Oh, yes, that's right.
their Epcot Project X, you know, was totally... But the Nazis were way ahead of their time, and we're looking at a group now that potentially, well, they seem to, according to your research, had the atomic bomb.
Yes, yes. I cover that case in the first of the books on the Nazi aspect of this story. All of my books are basically about a hidden, suppressed physics and the effects that this has had on our understanding of history. And I lay out the case that they actually were successful in their atom bomb program in a book called Reich of the Black Sun. And it's based largely on a circumstantial case that looks at certain anomalies in the Allied legend, as I like to call it, of why they supposedly failed. And one of the things I ran across, and I reproduced this document in the book, is an affidavit of a German pilot that was captured at the end of the war. And this affidavit was classified up until the year 1992. And when I read what was contained in it, I soon learned why it was classified for so long. Because this man claimed to have been the witness to an atomic bomb test that the Nazis performed on the island or near the island of Rügen in the Baltic Sea on sometime around October 10th through the 12th of 1944. Now, that in and of itself wouldn't be too significant, but what's significant in the document is that he's flying his plane as he's witness to this test. The plane's electrical equipment malfunctions, which, of course, is the product of electromagnetic pulse, which at that point, it's important to remember, at that point, as they're developing this nuclear technology, nobody realizes that this is going to be one of the results of detonating an atomic bomb. Okay. The next thing he describes is he describes the shockwave from this thing is visible to him out to a radius of about a kilometer, which is about what you'd expect for a medium-sized atomic bomb. But the most interesting thing to me is that he describes the cloud as being a mushroom cloud. That is his exact description of what he saw. And not only that, he describes the fact that you can see the continuing combustion of stuff burning in the cloud as it rises. In other words, a conventional explosive does not do that. It'll send up, of course, a cloud, but it won't have combustion of materials taking place in the cloud. And that, of course, is another telltale signature of an atomic blast. So you put all this together, and what this man is describing to his American interrogators after the end of the war is something that really is not yet even that well known, because the atom bombs that we dropped on Japan hadn't even been detonated yet. So in other words, this man's knowledge is accurate, and he's not the only such witness that we have to this alleged test of a German atom bomb in 1944. So, yeah, I do believe that there is a case to be made, a fairly strong case to be made, that the Nazi atom bomb project was not nearly the bungled thing that we have been led to believe it was.
Amazing stuff. Well, when they start to look at these things, we're looking even deeper than just the creation of an atomic bomb. We're looking at the potential of transmutation of elements such as mercury and gold.
Yes.
Let's talk a little alchemy, occult, and the engineering, and maybe lead this up to the Bell.
Well, yeah, this story is a part of the Bell Project, and for the listeners who don't know what the Bell Project was, the reason I began the Nazi series with a fairly thorough discussion of their atom bomb project is because that's kind of the context in which you have to understand the Nazi Bell Project. The Bell Project was the Third Reich's most sensitive classified secret research project. It was described in the literature as, and uniquely described in Nazi literature as something that was called Mitkriegsentscheidend, which means it was war decisive. Now, this term is not even used of their atom bomb project. In other words, it's so to speak, that the atom bomb is already sort of old news to them, you know.
Right.
It's sort of the pop gun. They're after something much, much bigger. And what the Bell Project is, then, to put it as succinctly as possible, is that the Germans were after a gateway technology that would lead them to the direct engineerable manipulation of the fabric of space-time itself. And they were after this technology for three different purposes. The first being that they were after it, of course, as an inexhaustible source of energy for Germany. The second reason they were after it is, of course, if you can manipulate the fabric of space-time, then you have a real, viable, practical field propulsion. In other words, you've got basically a key to anti-gravity. And then, of course, Nazis being Nazis, the third reason that you'd be after such a technology is, of course, if you weaponize that engineerability of the fabric of space-time, then theoretically you have a weapon potential that would make our largest hydrogen bombs look like firecrackers. You have something, in other words, that is potentially truly planet-busting stuff. So, yeah, the Bell Project is representative of all of these things. Now, the reason you mentioned alchemy and the transmutation of mercury into gold is that the head of the Bell Project was a very, very famous, internationally well-known German physicist by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach, all right? Gerlach was the actual scientist that was in charge of this Bell Project. He began, I believe, to research aspects of the Bell Project in the year 1924 because he published a short little article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, newspaper in Frankfurt, noting that certain German scientists had been able to produce small amounts of gold by subjecting mercury to high electrical stress, all right? And he actually mentions in this article the term alchemy in this respect. And he makes a typical scientist's plea for more money to research the phenomenon. And this was in the year 1924. In other words, it's fully 9 years before the Nazis even take power. So, in other words, I think that you can rationalize at least some of the aspects of the Bell Project as having begun even before the Nazis took power. And let's look at what Dr. Gerlach's specialty in physics is. He was the colleague of another famous German physicist by the name of Stern, and he and Stern performed the very famous physics experiment called the Stern-Gerlach experiment, in which they demonstrated that electrons have an electrical polarity that is due to their spin. So, in other words, Gerlach's specialty is everything connected with gravitation, magnetism, and the idea of rotating or spinning systems. All right? That's vitally important because in the Bell device, there was placed a serum called codenamed Serum 525. And if you dig in the literature long enough, you'll discover that this serum was composed probably of mercury and thorium and beryllium oxide. In other words, it was a very, very heavy liquid metal substance, a compound. Now, it's interesting because the Bell also subjected all of this serum not only to extremely high rotation, but it subjected this stuff to extremely high voltage direct current electrical pulsing. In other words, the whole parameter of the Bell project itself is directly tied to what Gerlach was writing about in 1924. So I believe that there is a strong possibility that the Bell project wasn't even a uniquely Nazi project. It was a secret project that was probably begun in the days of the Weimar Republic.
You know, recently we've had the relativistic heavy ionic collider, which is known as RIC, and they have two colliders known as Phoenix and Star.
Yes.
And they collided two gold particles and then found this disparity in space-time. This connects with the ideas of CERN and what's going on with today.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on CERN or this?
Funny you should ask. The Bell Project. Let's go back to the Bell just for a moment so that I can set up my answer to CERN. Inside this Bell device, you had these counter-rotating hollow drums that, in my rationalization of the device, were stacked one on top of the other, all right? They were spinning up this substance into an extremely high state of mechanical rotation, counter-rotation. Each of these drums spun in the opposite direction, all right? Now, to boil it all down, what I believe that the Nazis were trying to do with this device, in other words, they're trying to engineer the fabric of space-time locally, all right? Now, there was in the physics literature between the wars a way that you could do that, and it was called torsion, all right? And to give your listeners an idea of what the concept of torsion means, imagine taking an aluminum soda can, an empty aluminum soda can, and then you wring it in your hands like a dish rag. There's your counter-rotation. The can would represent the fabric of space-time itself. So the counter-rotation actually spirals and folds and pleats the can or the fabric of space-time. That's what torsion does, all right? Now, let's look at what the CERN Large Hadron Collider is. If you look at the structure of that collider, it's two very, very large counter-rotating magnetic circuits, all right, that are used to spin up particles in counter-rotation and then slam them together, all right? Now, I think what happened when they turned this on, and I'm going to crawl way out on a limb here because I have not heard any scientist rationalize. I mean, to listen to some of these scientists, they're coming up with things like dimensional gateways, and they ripped a fabric in time, and so on and so forth. And you even have one scientist from the Niels Bohr Institute in Denmark seriously proposing that time travelers have come back and shut the thing down.
Trying to shut down the time-traveling owl, no doubt about it, dropping pieces of baguette onto the system and shutting the thing down. Oh, this is going to be good, you guys. I hope you're enjoying it. You're listening to Radio Freeman. CERN's corporate logo being 666 and them having Shiva, the god of creation and destruction, out front, not to mention their colliders being named Atlas and Alice, while they're sending the Vatican's astronomer, Jesuit priest Benjamin Funes, over to it. CERN has been on my mind. This is one crazy operation that every nation wants to get a part of and are spending billions of dollars to get into, And what is it for? Just to find the God particle? I doubt it. Let's ask Joseph Farrell what he thinks about CERN.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the standard explanation, you know, they're rationalizing everything that has happened at CERN on the basis of the standard model of physics, and this is why I'm taking such time with the Bell. Let's go back to the fact that in the Bell device, you had these stacked counter-rotating cylinders to produce an extreme torsion shear effect, all right, a local variation in the fabric of space-time. Well, one of the results that was observed by the concentration camp inmates that survived the war, that actually worked on the Bell project, was that they would see this thing at night being tested outside, levitating above the tree lines and glowing a pale blue glow and then settling back down below the tree lines. In other words, the Nazis were successful, at least in one of their aims, and that was to achieve some sort of practical field propulsion technology by means of all of this very exotic engineering. Well, now let's go to CERN and the Large Hadron Collider. You've got these stacked, and there's the key word, counter-rotating magnets. Well, that's going to produce exactly what I described with our aluminum can example. It's going to produce, in my opinion, an extreme torsion shear. And the reason that the physicists are scratching their heads is because it's very important to understand that within standard conventional theory within physics, torsion is a very, very small and almost negligible effect in certain versions of the mathematics of torsion, all right? So I think when they turned on these magnets, what they got was something utterly outside the standard model. They're not getting time travelers or any of this happy nonsense, but what they are getting is an extreme torsion shear, and it may even be the case that this whole collider all of a sudden started to pull away from its moorings. In other words, it started to levitate. Yeah. And that may, in fact, be the reason why the first explanation that, you know, it caused a rupture in one of the helium cooling tanks around these enormous magnets to rupture. Because if you're designing a device based on standard models of physics where the effect of torsion shear is so negligible, you're not going to be designing it for stresses like that. And if all of a sudden this whole thing decides to start levitating, yeah, it's going to put some stress on your cooling tanks. So yeah, I think something like that has happened, and it's at the back to the drawing boards, because I think they achieved an effect that is utterly outside of the standard models and paradigms that they were working with.
I think you're right. They had no idea what was going to happen. Same thing with HARP and the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project.
Now, yes.
When CERN was at world record levels at the moment the Norway spiral was coming up over Obama's Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I was tracking this with the Cloud of Care, which was an aluminum oxide cloud burst out into the atmosphere at the height of the International Space Station. That was launched out of the Wallops Flight Facility, what's also known as Mars. And then following this was the Norway spiral, which seemed to also be the release of an aluminum oxide cloud because it shone blue in the light, and that was the base element of sapphire. So then it seemed to be pulsed by what's the Solvabard antenna array there in Norway.
Yes.
Do you think that these are experiments in time control devices, or what do you think? Do you have any
ideas? Well, I don't necessarily conceive of them as time control, but I do think of them in specifically that particular manifestation of it. I do think of it as a not so much a test of torsion technology, but a demonstration of it. And the reason I say that is we have to look very carefully at the timing of the Norway spiral, not only in terms of President Obama's trip to receive his Peace Prize, but also in terms of the fact that the Russians just so happened to be testing one of their latest missiles at that juncture. And this thing is, the European version of HARP is fired up, and the missile flies into this thing, and no more Russian missile, essentially, is what we had. Now, to me, it's very interesting because the country with the major stake in that European version of HARP is precisely Germany. All right? And Chancellor Merkel, it's very interesting to me that, number one, this lady is a PhD in quantum chemistry, all right? In other words, she's a scientist, and she's fully capable, with that kind of background, of understanding some of the physics principles involved, not only in that project, but in its potential application as, guess what, a missile defense shield. And what has Chancellor Merkel been saying, basically, to the United States? Well, you know, we don't need your missile shield. We don't want your missile shield. Well, the reason that, you know, she doesn't is because they just gave us a pretty good demonstration of their own. That's what I think has happened. So, yeah, I think you had a clear message being sent, not only to President Obama, but to the Russians, that, you know, we're well and fully capable of defending ourselves. And to me, it's very interesting because now the Russians are all on board the idea of a European missile defense system that basically is not reliant, heavily reliant, upon American technology. So, yeah, I think clear messages were being sent by certain people in Berlin to certain people in Moscow and Washington.
Now, what do you think of this, the Polish plane crash? And investigators have not yet drawn conclusions about what caused the crash of all the Polish military and top civilian leaders. 95 died along with Kaczynski. This seemed to be right around the same time that they were trying to push this missile defensive shield there in Poland. Do you think that there's some connection?
Well, if I recall correctly, I don't remember what the stance of that particular Polish government was to all of this, but I do view that event with some suspicion. Although, that being said, I have to be very honest and say that I have not investigated it very thoroughly at all. But my gut reaction is, you know, this is hardly coincidental.
Yeah, I think the whole government. Well, we're back up on the break, Joseph. These hours go by fast. When we get back, we're going to dig into the Babylonian banksters, the ideas of money, and probably more of this crazy science. No doubts. Be right back. My very special guest, Joseph Farrell, author of The Giza Death Star, The Philosopher's Stone, Babylon's Banksters, and much more. The SS, Brotherhood of the Bell, Reich and the Black Sun. So many things I'd love to talk with you about, Joseph. I wanted to throw in a little Space War news right now because we're in the short break. We've only got 5 minutes. So it seems that the unmanned X-37B, the secret space plane, will be returning to land at Vandenberg Air Force Base, most likely this Friday, perhaps Monday. Meanwhile, the NASA space program coming to its closing. It looks like the Discovery Shuttle and Robonaut 2 will not be launching out until at least December 17th. Mm-hmm. As we're looking at this crazy new space war program going up all over around us, do you have any thoughts on that in these few minutes we got?
Well, yeah, I think it is an egregious mistake for the United States to abdicate its space program and to allow the other nations of the world to get into space in a serious way, to go back to the moon and so on and so forth. I think it is an absolute error simply because the benefits that the Apollo program had technologically to this country and economically to this country, the cost-to-benefit ratio of that program far, far exceeded anyone's imagination. So much of what we have now and take for granted is in many ways a direct result of the Apollo program. So simply from a standpoint of economic security, I think the United States has to maintain a leadership position in space matters. There, you know, and I know I'm echoing President Kennedy there, but that, you know, that is essentially my philosophy is pretty much identical to his. But the other part of your question implies that there is a secret agenda, and, you know, I'm four square in agreement with Richard Hoagland and some other people that have addressed the topic, that there is a kind of a secret space program that has been going on in parallel, if you will, with the public version that we see, you know, launching on rockets and so on and so forth. And it may be that what we're looking at is the winding down of NASA so that this other program can continue full bore and full speed, but unbeknownst to the American people.
Well, they didn't hide in their symbolism. There's no doubt when they announced the Ares space program, and of course, Ares being Mars and the god of war.
Right. And, right.
Oh, yes, Obama bringing that right to fruition. I mean, as soon as he came in, he was coupling the DOD with NASA and ready to move this into a space operation. Then we had the launch of the X-37B, the HTV-2, and then we have all of these unmanned stealth attack robotic vehicles like the Falcon.
Yes.
Is this the Nazi dream coming to truth, coming to life?
Actually, I think it may be something more complex. I think we may be looking at a kind of a covert space war going on right over our heads, and the protagonists in that conflict may very well be partly some surviving element of this post-war Nazi extraterritorial state that I mentioned in the first hour. And in fact, in my opinion, it's very possible that that's the case. I think that there are probably other players, but yes, I think you may be looking at some sort of conflict actually taking place right over our heads, and I think this may have been going on for at least a decade.
Amazing stuff. We'll be right back. Before we get to the rodents at the other end of the rat lines, we had a couple of follow-up questions from the chat room, Joseph. They were wondering if the Giza pyramid was a weapon, who was it a weapon against?
Okay, in my scenario, in my basic model, there is, in modern astronomy, there is an idea called the exploded planet hypothesis that was put out by the former naval astronomer Dr. Tom Van Flandern. And basically, he uses an old astronomical model from the 19th century that the asteroid belt is, in fact, the remains of an exploded planet right here in our solar system. And he, in his book, discussed a number of potential natural models for why a planet would spontaneously explode. But eventually, he kind of comes down to the fact that none of these are terribly satisfactory, and actually admits the possibility that it may have been done by deliberate action. And in my reading, if you look at ancient texts, this is precisely what you find discover in things like the Enuma Elish, if you know how to read the planetary codes that are in that text. The planet is called Tiamat in those texts, and it was not blown up, as in Sitchin's scenario, by another celestial body colliding into it. If you read the text carefully, it specifically states that it was blown up as a deliberate act in this war. So in other words, I think that the possibility arises that if my hypothesis is correct, that the Great Pyramid represents a gigantic torsion manipulation machine, that the possibility arises that it may have been targeting that planet, all right? And again, we have to understand that the Great Pyramid is naturally resonant to the Schumann cavity resonance of the Earth. In other words, it is drawing on the energy of this entire planet. If you can draw on that kind of energy, and if you have a means of manipulating torsion fields and directing them to specific targets, then yes, it is feasible that this thing was actually used in an act of planetary destruction. So I hope that answers the question adequately.
Definitely. Another question was about Shesh Hari. Uh-huh. And your little discussion that you were having, and the listener wanted to know if you felt that Iapetus might be a space platform capable of doing the same type of torsion physics?
Well, clearly Iapetus does have distinct hallmarks of being an artificial body. I mean, anyone who's looked at the pictures, anyone who's read Mr. Hoagland's analysis of NASA's pictures and his analysis of the weirdly Sumerian dimensions of its orbit around Saturn, and that's about the only way to put it, is that they're weirdly Sumerian. I think you have to open the possibility that it is an artificial body. Now, whether or not it's an actual weapon, that's another matter. Mr. Hoagland tends not to think that that's the case. I kind of vacillate back and forth between the two. I have had a kind of an ongoing discussion with the author, Seth Sherry, that it's not necessary, if you understand the physics involved, it's not necessary to build this type of weaponry and put it on a space platform. It actually would be much better and more efficient to place it on an actual planetary body. But, you know, that's six of one, half a dozen of another. It's kind of nitpicking in a certain way.
Okay, and the final question was, if we're in a space war, are we talking about a space war between nations, or are we talking about extraterrestrial Earth war? And maybe a comment on the bombing of the moon?
Okay. In my view,
these chat room questions are tough, I'll tell you.
Well, in my view, I think you have definite messages being sent between Earth-based nations, number one, in this covert space war. But in addition to that, I think you have Earth-based factions that are not necessarily tied to any specific nation state. In other words, you know, if you're granting the proposition that there is a post-war surviving Nazi extraterritorial state, and that would imply organization, that would imply an intelligence service, that would imply its own independent source of funding, its own personnel to conduct operations and research and so on and so forth. In other words, when I say a post-war Nazi extraterritorial state, that's what I mean, all right?
Right.
So I think you have the possibility that you're also looking at a shooting war not only between the nations of the Earth, but if you factor in this post-war Nazi international, as I like to call it, then they would be players in this because, again, going back to the Bell, this is precisely the technology that they've been researching since before World War II. And in my reading of certain projects that were taking place in Argentina after the war, it looks to me to be a very definite case that they continued the Bell project independently after the war. So in other words, yeah, you take 65 years and enough money and enough manpower, and what would they have come up with in that time? Well, the sky's the limit, quite literally. Now, you mentioned extraterrestrials. I definitely hold the possibility that some of what we've been seeing in terms of demonstrations of advanced technology in outer space could be the entry of an off-world player into this whole scenario. But when I say that, I don't want listeners to get creepy ideas about little gray aliens or reptilians or any of the happy nonsense that's going on in the field of ufology. Because if you look very directly, again, at the ancient texts, we have cousins out there that are genetically similar enough to us that we could be engineered into existence and interbreed with them. So in other words, the human family, the genus Homo sapiens, is, at least as far as the ancient texts are concerned, is not confined to this planet. So in other words, when I say I admit the possibility that some of this is extraterrestrial, I do not want people to get pictures of little gray aliens in their heads. I want them to get pictures of people that look like us, walk like us, and talk like us, and that may be, for all practical intents and purposes, indistinguishable from us.
Right. I believe that as well. And I'm into the Billy Meyer story and understanding that these are humans, seemingly advanced humans. And of course, we got the film The Event that's bringing that, or the TV series bringing that very idea out to us.
Yeah, you know, it's as if television, with the recent spate of, you know, alien invasion scenarios, I mean, my word, they're rerunning Independence Day, you know, and the television program that you mentioned, The Event, and so on and so forth. It seems that they are trying to prep the climate of opinion for some sort of scenario. So, yeah, I tend to agree with you.
I don't know if you probably didn't hear the news that I covered earlier, is that NASA is setting an extraterrestrial search update, and they're having a major press conference this Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern with a bunch of, well, we've got a geologist, an oceanographer, a biologist, and an ecologist all coming together to discuss extraterrestrial life. Now, we've also had the Mozzie and Othman with the Royal Society, and we've had the UN and all of this extraterrestrial news coming out.
Right.
It definitely seems like they're trying to put something into the consciousness of humanity to prepare us for, you know, a proper reaction is what I think. You know, they would get the proper reaction out of us.
Right, right. And, you know, the themes that they've been driving, it seems to me, is that we have to prepare ourselves for the, you know, for the worst.
Right.
So, you know, again, if humanity developed these torsion-based technologies and managed to weaponize these technologies, as I think is the clear implication of the Nazi Bell Project and some other things done in some other countries, then, yeah, this is going to be of immediate concern to anybody out there that this cantankerous lot down here on planet Earth has access to these types of toys.
You thought you got a lot of flying saucers when we set off some nukes. Try this one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, yeah, I was looking at these the list of 88 dead scientists and microbiologists, the Marconi scientist mystery that seems to have killed off so many of these scientists getting into these type of technologies.
Yes.
And the Nazis seemed to do the same thing as they closed a shop up there and killed off what they could.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a key point that you mentioned. And I mentioned that in my book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. At the end of World War II, the SS literally murdered, executed 60 of the scientists that were involved in the Bell Project. And to me, this is the clearest indicator that the Nazis are so intent upon keeping this project secret from the Allies and from the Soviets that they intend to pursue independently this project after the war. And that's exactly what I believe they did. And it's very interesting to note another fact, and it's one that few people appreciate. And that is, at the end of the war, as the Allied and Soviet armies are closing in on the Third Reich, that it is the Nazis themselves who are driving the technological division of the spoils. And if you look at what they're doing and how they're doing it, they're setting it up very, very cleverly so that basically the Western Allies and the Soviet bloc get roughly an equal division of the spoils so that they will stalemate themselves. And it's, you know, a replay of classic German diplomacy, because Germany's geopolitical situation is such that they've always had, by dint of their position, to play off East against West in order to give themselves maneuvering room. And I believe that's exactly what the Nazis did with their technological division of the spoils. But note, they kept the Bell Project to themselves. The most sophisticated of all of their secret projects, and the one that would, in the long run, pay them the largest dividends. Because, after all, if we're dealing with a technology that manipulates the fabric of space-time directly and locally, then, yeah, an atom bomb or even a hydrogen bomb is going to be like a pop gun.
And just turn back time and it's over, right?
Yeah.
No worries there. Well, just sorting out our time base here, whether I wanted to get you to another question here. A lot of that Nazi technology seemed to go down to South and Central America. And
yes.
Like Paraguay seems to have a town of twins there. Mengele was known to have inhabited.
Actually, that's in Brazil. But yes, that work, I believe, is directly traceable to the post-war activity of Mengele.
So now we're looking at the fact that the Bush family, HW and W, have now also purchased a 120,000-acre ranch down in Paraguay. And I'm beginning to wonder if we're not looking towards the war tribunal of America and kind of another Nazi shift and moving them to another area.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the game plan is. I do find it very suspicious that the Bush family, with its ties through Prescott Bush to the Nazis prior to World War II, I do think it extremely suspicious that the Bush family would make that purchase in that country, which was and is such a haven for these Nazi enclaves. And, you know, just to give you an idea of how Nazified the country was, when Juan Perón's government, the first government, fell, he went into exile at first in Paraguay with his good old friend Alfred Stroessner. And, you know, Stroessner is hardly a Spanish name. So, you know, the president of Paraguay having a very German last name is kind of a dead giveaway.
I would think so. Yeah, another famous German now, also from Bavaria, and a Nazi youth is Pope Ratzinger.
Yes,
now known as Pope Benedict.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Just recently, he had discovered this 600-year-old document that absolved the Knights Templar of all their heresies.
Yep.
I find this a very interesting timing as well, as he comes out and announces that this crucial document hadn't been seen for almost 700 years, and they published it as a book, The Processus Contra Templarios, and was published with the Vatican Secret Archives on October 25th, and is selling for somewhere around $8,700 a piece. The Knights Templar are another one that would lead into this same story, would they not?
Well, I think they do in a kind of a roundabout way. The Templars were, of course, Europe's first modern bankers. They were the world's first truly modern international bankers. And I do think that there is a case to be made that whatever they discovered in the Holy Land, either the church paid them hush money or it was being blackmailed. And the whole way that you know, King Philip le Bel in France attempted to shut them down basically only dispersed them. So, I think they're kind of a roundabout part of the story, but in a way that leads more directly to financial policy rather than to modern, you know, space wars and things of that sort. I think that there is a definite case to be made that they find themselves in the genealogical tree, so to speak, of modern fraternal societies like the Masons and the Rosicrucians and so on and so forth.
I was kind of trying to lead you in that direction because I made a prediction, and I use my occult knowledge and combine it with politics and make projections and decide. And I managed to predict a banking crash for 10/13, and I had stated it to the world and even on Alex Jones' show that 10/13 would be the next 9/11. And sure enough, 10/13 fell, and that was the day that Bernanke, Ben Bernanke, brought all the bankers in and started this whole banker bailout.
Right.
And the 10/13 is symbolic of the day that the Papal Bull came out, that elusive or infamous Friday the 13th, October 13th, 1307. And I was using some clues that Pope Ratzinger had given me by meeting with W in St. John's Tower, or, the fact that he was connected to all of this and a Nazi youth himself. But I had some signs and symbols that showed me that they would use this symbolic date of 10/13 to do this very thing. And now we have the major UFO flap on 10/13. I wasn't even thinking about that at this time. But I would like to get into the rodents at the other end of the rat lines, the idea of the unholy trinity, and get into our banking crisis and its occult connections. So when we get back, we're going to look into money and let's just look at some of the esoteric policies behind it. As the sun fades the brown. In recent news, China and Russia have decided to renounce the U.S. dollar and resort to using their own currencies for bilateral trade. Premier Wen Jiabao and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin announced on Tuesday, and Chinese experts say the move reflected closer relations with Beijing and Moscow and is not aimed at challenging the dollar, but to protect their domestic economies. We're at the break here. We are at the moment where the esoteric dollar, the money system, is going to completely shift. We have Kazakhstan talking about putting out international money called ACMetal. And let's jump right into the money. Well, what is it? To me, this is the most esoteric form of magic we've got going on.
Well, yeah, I cover the roots of all of this in my book called Babylon's Banksters, and the roots of monetary policy are literally that ancient. And essentially, you have two different forms of money. And the first form has always been the issuance by a state of debt-free money based on essentially the goods and services of the state. In other words, the gross domestic product. In other words, money, real money, is nothing but a receipt for the goods and services of a given nation. All right? So it's always, always debt-free. And this was the way that money first existed way, way back in Mesopotamia. The other form of money is what I prefer to call the facsimile of money. And this is where money is not issued by a state, but loaned into circulation by a private monopoly that gets its hands on a state's money supply. And this goes way, way back again to ancient times. You can see the clear activity of these classes of people even in ancient times. The problem with that system of money is that a bank, as anyone knows, can never, ever create enough money in circulation, loan enough money in circulation to pay the interest on a debt. So you're always, always dealing in a system that's a vast Ponzi scheme that eventually breaks down because, again, there's never enough money in circulation on principle of the debt. So under that system, nations can only go further and further and further into debt. And the way out of it has always been exactly what the 13 colonies pursued prior to the Revolutionary War. It is exactly what President Lincoln pursued in his financing of the Northern effort during the war between the states. It is exactly the kind of money that President Kennedy was attempting to go back to when he issued his executive order for the creation of and circulation of $4 billion of United States notes. It's exactly the system of money that Adolf Hitler put the Nazi regime under when he took power in Germany. And incidentally, it is exactly the system of money that communist China is under. There is no private monopoly loaning Chinese money into circulation. It is created by the Chinese government itself against the gross domestic product of the nation. So it's no wonder the Chinese economy is booming. You know, because every time the experiment has been tried, that is the result. We had nearly full employment in the 13 colonies under that system of money. And Adolf Hitler, when he took over Germany, of course, it was economically on its last legs. And there was greater than 10% unemployment in that country. In fact, it was oftentimes as high as 20%. When he took over and created that system of money in Nazi Germany, within literally a short period of 3 years, the German economy was absolutely booming. So, yeah, we have a decision. We have a choice we can make, and that is to return to the constitutional basis of money in this country and eventually either get rid of the Federal Reserve altogether or simply nationalize the thing and make constitutional debt-free money as the basis of our monetary system. The thing that I found unusual is that in those bailout hearings, let's go back to what I said in the first hour. At the end of World War II, you've got these Nazis sitting on top of a vast pile of loot in the form of liquid assets that have to be laundered somehow. So I believe a deal was struck between that surviving post-war Nazi elite and the surviving Anglo-American corporate elite to move all that money into Western banks. But here's the problem. Anytime you're dealing with the likes of Martin Bormann and these Nazis, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. Okay?
<All right. laughs>
So in other words, these Nazis are, you know, that money that you're getting into your banks, Mr. Rockefeller and Lord Rothschild, that money is going to come with a very, very heavy marker. And at some point, that marker is going to come due, and you'd better be able to pay up when that time comes. And I think that's precisely what we're seeing right now, beginning with those bailout hearings. Because, my word, what's this idea of no oversight? To me, it smacks of people with a gun being pointed to their head. And they better pay up, and they can't tell the government who they're paying all this money to, really, because if that were to get out, then, yeah, you know, all HE double toothpicks would break loose. So the behavior of these bankers in those bailout hearings, to me, was that of people being blackmailed, quite literally. So I think, yeah, you're looking at a financial meltdown, but I think there's a certain amount of good coming out of it. People are finally waking up to the idea that we cannot, and no nation can, survive and preserve its national sovereignty under a system of monetized debt where every note in circulation is quite literally an interest-bearing note. That's why they're called Federal Reserve notes. Every dollar that you spend is nothing but monetized debt.
And what can you tell us about David Lee's formula?
Well, David Lee, that's very interesting. I begin Babylon's Banksters with kind of a short introduction about that. David Lee was a Chinese mathematician and economist who at the time was working for the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, which is a bank with heavy Rothschild ties. David Lee came up with a formula that's called a Gaussian copula formula. It's a kind of a statistical formula in which he was trying to tie together and correlate all sorts of credit debt default swaps in a neat and tidy formula that would evaluate the risk involved with each bundle of credit defaults, all right? Here's the problem. When he came up with the formula, he deliberately discarded all the historical data, and there wasn't that much to begin with on these kinds of securities instruments. But he deliberately discarded all historical data and said that we can create a reliable risk assessment formula based solely on market prices, all right? What that did, in effect, once the formula worked its way into certain banking houses, and notably, the formula didn't really work its way into German banking houses, but once it worked its way into these other banks, it began to create the bubble. The problem was the formula took no account of historical data, and when certain prices that were bundled into these securities, such as mortgages and housing costs and so on and so forth, began to turn down, the effect of that, of the formula on all these credit bundles, was simply to explode the bubble. All right. Now, it's interesting to me that after all this happens, Dr. Li returned to Communist China, where he took a post in an official Chinese government agency doing nothing but assessing risk, the very same thing, in other words, that he was doing for the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce when he came up with this wonderful, infamous formula. That, to me, suggests very strongly the possibility that the formula was contrived deliberately as a kind of form of economic warfare.
Well, I would agree with that, and it seems that I know all the sci-fi films have us speaking Chinese in there. they write this down. Well, okay, so now this is brought about, we're starting to see the kind of the secret government forming around us as well, and we have now the Bilderberg Group.
Yes.
What do you think is the purpose of the Bilderbergs?
Okay, that I get into in Babylon's Banksters as well, and it comes directly out of what I've said. At the end of World War II, you've got essentially, number one, a devastated Europe. You have all these post-war Nazis sitting on top of a vast pile of loot, and you've got these Anglo-American banksters who want to get their hands on it. So in my hypothesis, let's look at who is forming the Bilderberg Group. Well, on the Anglo-American side, you have the heavy involvement of the Rockefeller family, you have the heavy involvement of the Rothschilds, all right? To be predicted, to be expected. But on the European side, who is behind the formation of the group? Well, it just happens to be Prince Bernhard. Well, who's Prince Bernhard? He's a German prince. He's an SS officer. And this is very important, because if there is a post-war surviving extraterritorial Nazi state with a legitimate continuing chain of command, that puts Prince Bernhard, under his SS oath, into a position where he's answering to whoever is the head of that chain of command, and most likely that would be Martin Bormann, all right? Prince Bernhard is also was in a managerial position within the huge German chemicals combine known as IG Farben. And one of the early and regular attendees at those Bilderberg meetings was none other than Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who was the president and CEO of Deutsche Bank, all right? And incidentally, during the war, Dr. Ops was also in a handling bank in Berlin that handled all the accounts for the Reich government. In other words, this was the guy that signed the check to Adolf Hitler paying his salary as chancellor. Getting the picture?
Yes.
So when the Bilderberg Group is formed, I believe the true purpose is simply to coordinate the financial policies and activities between the surviving post-war Nazi elite and that Anglo-American elite, and to make all of that money, turn it around, and use that money after it's been laundered to help rebuild Europe and create the European Union. And it's very important to remember that Martin Bormann made it one of his explicit post-war goals to create a European federation which, in his own words, Germany would be able to dominate by elastic political means, and that is exactly what has happened. And you need go no further than to go online and pull up YouTube and look at all the revival of Prussian military tradition within the modern German military to see exactly what's going on.
Amazing. So these would be the rodents at the other end of the rat line.
Well, the rodents at the other end of the rat lines, that's the title of a chapter in my book, The Nazi International. And the rodents, in this case, is precisely Juan Perón's Argentina. because Perón, of course, was a Nazi-file. He just thought they were the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know. And he, you know, we've heard so much about Vatican involvement in smuggling these Nazis out of Europe, even American and British involvement in doing so. But what we don't realize is that Argentina itself played a major role in smuggling a lot of Nazi scientists to Argentina, where, predictably enough, they got right back to their old shenanigans of investigating their secret weapons research projects and doing it under the cloak of Perón's government. But when you read what they're up to and how they're up to it, it is very clear that Perón is not the one in control of these projects. It's coming from somewhere else, and it's certainly not coming from the United States of America.
Right. Well, would this money theory fit into their hyperdimensional unified field theory at all? Is this stepping outside bounds here? Perhaps. I think we're up on the break again. Well, we're almost done with the show.
American Freedom Radio.
We've done a pretty good job of rewriting history tonight, Joseph. I really wanted to ask you just one more question, and of course, some more follow-ups, because we only have a few more minutes. This information can be quite dangerous, and you have now put yourself out there in front of the public eye, allowing everyone to know that you're thinking these thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what you hope to achieve, what you want to get out of this, and why you went ahead and put your life on the line to write such books as The Giza Death Star, The Babylonian Bankers, or The Philosopher's Stone.
Well, one of the things I'm hoping to achieve is number one, to wake people up and get them, you know, I'm not concerned that people agree with me so much, but that they start learning to think on their own and to trust their own mind and to question the standard explanations that have been given out by religion or scientists. You know, anymore, there's not much difference between the two.
Right.
But, you know, to question things. And then number two, I hope to spur people to the realization, and this is a major theme in my books, although it's kind of a subtle one, and that is that there is a direct relationship between consciousness and the physical medium, and that we do therefore have power to change things simply by, if I can put it simply and bluntly, simply by thinking positive thoughts, or if you're the praying sort, praying against all of the wickedness and evil that we see some of these self-appointed elites up to. It literally can be done if we get out of our apocalyptic gloom and doom mode. So that's the other thing I'm hoping to do, is simply wake people up. You know, I discuss a lot of evil things and a lot of evil potentials in my books, but I also want people to realize that these things, these technologies, these theories that I've been writing about are coming down the pike at us at breakneck speed. And we can either grow up as a race, or we can succumb to the temptations that they represent. So that really is my motivation. I don't know how to put it any more plainly.
I like that. Because I firmly believe in your idea of the consciousness shift. And really, to me, that's the only thing that's going to change anything on this planet. I don't believe legislation, any
right.
politics are going to change a thing until we change our reason for being.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, the nature of things is such, you know, in my study of this physics, you know, all the way from ancient times to modern times, I am convinced that the nature of the physical medium at root and basically is, truly, is love. And if this doesn't form the principal motivation of the human heart, then we are lost as a species. And, you know, it's just that simple.
I wholeheartedly agree. Well, can you tell everyone how they can get a hold of your books?
The easiest way, I have two different publishers, and one of them is Adventures Unlimited Press, and the number, toll-free number for them is 1-800-718-4514, and that's during normal business hours, please. My other publisher is Feral House, F-E-R-A-L, and I can't ever remember their number off the top of my head, but they, you know, you can find them by Googling that name online. And of course, you can get my books through Amazon. You just type in the title or type in my name, and they'll pull them up.
And is your main website the Giza Death Star?
Yes, yeah, www.GizaDeathStar.com, all lowercase, all one word. And I have to admit, I've been so busy writing books that I haven't had time to update the site, you know, do articles on the website, yeah.
Sure. I'm totally on the opposite side of the spectrum. I'm so busy doing radio, I can't write my book. I want to, though. I have a lot of thoughts and theories that I hope to get out. I've been looking at this picture for quite some time, and I've come to a lot of similar conclusions with the Nazi connections and the neo-Nazis. Do you have any thoughts about what's going on with the neo-Nazis and how this is unfolding now?
Well, first of all, I am increasingly coming to the opinion that there's no such thing as a neo-Nazi. They're just plain old Nazis.
Okay.
They are plugged into this extraterritorial Nazi state. But the other thing the other activity that I think that this extraterritorial Nazi state has been heavily involved with, and this is a matter of quite some documentation, I'm not the only one out there saying it, is that they, very early on, prior to World War II, made deep, deep ties with elements within the radical Muslim world, and that much of the terrorism that we see now, that so many people say has to be state-sponsored from somewhere, and, you know, you get the usual list of people doing it, Iran and Saudi Arabia and so on. I think that people have to wake up and realize that there's another possibility behind and another possible sponsor behind all these activities, and that is ultimately this post-war Nazi extraterritorial state.
All right. Well, that will definitely clear some things up as we start to look at things like 9/11, and was it an inside job or was it a global job? Or when we're looking at Wernher von Braun's fears, saying that it would be the Red Scare, terrorism, followed by asteroids and aliens.
Yep, exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Joseph, for joining
us. Thank you for having me on.
I hope someday we can meet.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, that would be fine.
All right. Well, there you have it, folks. Joseph Farrell here live on Radio Freeman. From American Freedom Radio. Get all the links and everything else over at freemantv.com. Love one another. Start to live. Enjoy life. See you all Thursday.